As we continue our Psalms for the summer, we come now upon Psalm 128, one of the most abused Psalms, one of the most taken out of context Psalms, because it is one that is quick to be twisted into the plans of the prosperity gospel preachers and the health and wealth gospel preachers. And that's not just the charlatans we're used to seeing on TV with terrible toupees and whatever else. There are many other forms of it. We won't touch on all of them today. But it is very much in us to seek to find immediate earthly gratification for what we do. And this psalm lends itself to be twisted into that way without understanding its context. So look at its context a lot today, and then look at how we would apply a psalm written in an old covenant context to the way Christians live today in the new covenant. Hear now the word of the Lord, Psalm 128, verse 1. How happy is everyone who fears the Lord, who walks in his ways. You will surely eat what your hands have worked for. You will be happy, and it will go well for you. Your wife will be like a fruitful vine within your house, your children like young olive trees around your table. In this very way, the man who fears the Lord will be blessed. May the Lord bless you from Zion so that you will see the prosperity of Jerusalem all the days of your life and will see your children's children. Peace be with Israel. The word of the Lord. Okay, kids, this is not just time for the grown-ups, okay? All eyes and ears up here because God speaks to you just as much as he does to the grown-ups, and he loves you just as much as he loves the grown-ups. And it's important for you to know how you can tell God and show God that you love him. Let me ask you a question. Have you ever said, or maybe you thought, unless I get this thing I want, I'll never be happy again? Never thought that? Maybe it was a certain toy you wanted, and you thought, if I don't get that toy, I'll never be happy. Or maybe it was somewhere you wanted to go, like maybe to a friend's house or to a cousin's house, or maybe you wanted to go to Disney World and like, unless I get to go there, I'll never be happy. You ever thought stuff like that? Yeah. Adults do that too, okay? They might not say it stamping their feet like kids, but we can easily think that unless I have what I want, I'll never be happy. Well, today's Bible verses that I just read, they talked about being happy. And they said that God is the one who makes us happy if we trust in him. How does that work? Well, if we really understand what God's done for us, we remember that he said, if anyone believes in Jesus, Jesus will pay for their sins. And they'll come home with me to heaven forever. And I'll love them like they've never sinned ever, forever. Is there any toy you could have here or fun day at a park that's better than being in heaven forever and God loving you as much as he loves Jesus? Is there anything better than that? Mm-mm. But you can't see heaven right now, can you? Right? And we can't see a picture. We can't watch on TV God saying, I love you. So sometimes we don't think about it because we can't see it. We think more about the toy that I can see or the friend that I can see. I think more about those. But what's most important is what lasts forever. Can any of your toys last forever? Can you play at Disney World forever? What a nightmare. Nothing here will last forever, but God's love for you and being in heaven with all the other Christians and God, that will last forever. That's where true happiness is found. So next time you find yourself thinking, I'll never be happy unless I have this thing, remember, that won't last. But if you believe in Jesus, God's love for you will last and you'll be in heaven forever and ever and ever. Can you ask God to help you think about that more and to help you think about it during the sermon? Thank you, kids, for listening. So how can we find happiness in the Lord? That's what the psalm's all about. And we're going to have to do some throat clearing in the beginning to remove some of the abuse of the psalm, and then we'll dig in to how we apply this psalm. To find true happiness in the Lord, first, we must understand the fear of the Lord. We must understand what is the fear of the Lord. Second, We must understand true Christian. What I mean by that is here now in the new covenant. We must understand true Christian happiness. And then finally, we must see that God produces and sustains this happiness. God produces and sustains this happiness. So first, understanding the fear of the Lord. Again, verse 1 says, "How happy is everyone who fears the Lord, who walks in his ways." So I said we're going to clear out some misunderstanding first and then look at what that fear of the Lord means. This psalm, again, has been so abused by so many. And what they miss are two things we're going to dig into in a second. I'm going to throw them out here and then we'll dig into them more. This psalm misses the old covenant context of this psalm and the kind of literature this psalm is. This is Old Testament wisdom literature. So first of all, Old Testament wisdom literature is not giving out contracts to people that they can go redeem like a coupon with God. Wisdom literature states general truths that generally happen, okay? So it says things like, if you live this way, here's the typical result. Okay, it's not a contract you have with God. Hey, you said if I did this, I was guaranteed this. No, that's not how wisdom literature works. Second of all, it misses the fact that the Old Covenant promises lots of very specific physical blessings for obedience and very specific physical punishments for disobedience. You obey, your crops are going to grow. You disobey, I send famine. So this psalm was written in that time when God dealt with his people like that. He does not make similar statements in the new covenant. So here and now we have to do what I've said to you before, the covenantal math. Okay, how do we look at that situation and understand how it would apply in a different covenant? But yet, that is still scripture breathed out by God. Therefore, we know it's useful for rebuking, correcting, and training in righteousness. But how do we do it so as to not misunderstand or lose that original context or drag it into our context where it doesn't relate the same way? Well, yeah, like I said, we'll dig into this later. So I'm not saying that God never in the new covenant physically blesses us. Of course he does. I'm not saying the only blessing you can ever expect to happen in the new covenant is only spiritual. I'm not saying that. We should expect that God would bless those following him in ways that physically have things going better. We should expect that rebellion against him would bring along some physical consequences of things not going well. But this is due to how God's design for his world generally works. Keeping in harmony with his design, things generally go well. Bucking his design for things, things generally don't go well, okay? But that's different from turning this psalm into a contractual agreement. If I fear you, Lord, you owe me a wife who cranks out useful children. And a lot of them, okay? So some examples of the abuse of this psalm. I said before to you, the health and wealth or the prosperity gospel. Again, we're used to seeing some of these guys on TV. If you have enough faith, God will heal all of your ills. That faith needs to be expressed, by the way, by sending me a check for the following amount. And we pretty readily see how horrible abuse that is. And again, they're always off the hook because they're always saying, if you have enough faith, my magical prayers or oil that I've prayed over will solve all your problems. Well, they didn't solve my problems. Oh, well, you didn't have enough faith. I don't think too many of you are suffering under that. If you are, we definitely need to have a talk. But we're used to that. I don't know if we're used to it in some other circles. There are other ones in very conservative areas. Some of them would be maybe loosely associated with what goes on out in Moscow, Idaho. But not saying everyone involved there does this. But there has been a version of this since the 80s. Floating around, some would call it theonomic. If you don't know what that means, it doesn't matter. I'm not indicting all theonomic people under this, but some in those circles have said, no, the Old Testament law is the way God has designed his world to function. It still is binding today, not the sacrificial part, of course. Christ took care of that. And these Old Covenant ways of thinking, what we see here in this psalm, if you do this, then God physically blesses you with that, is very much alive today. So if you see a Christian doing well financially, you should assume they're fearing the Lord. And if they're not, you should assume there's some kind of secret sin. And that's the flip side of this. Often the health and wealth side, in addition to giving false hope for physical blessings that God hasn't guaranteed, people who are victims of misfortune are very often treated like Job's friends treat him. Clearly, this is because of your sin. If you're undergoing some kind of misfortune, God is showing you his displeasure, and you've done something out with it. What is it? I worked among Pentecostal circles for a while, and not at a church, but at a parachurch ministry. And I don't know how often I heard this. So-and-so just, this misfortune just befell them. What kind of secret sin do you think they're hiding? Like, really? First of all, I'm sure we all have secret sins we're hiding. I'm not saying that doesn't happen, but is that really your first thought? They broke their leg in the soccer game. I wonder what they were doing last night. Just breeds terrible things. And I think those of us who have been unfortunately associated or taught by Bill Gothardite ministries and some of the more extreme forms of fundamentalism there, of which I have definitely worked alongside as well, very similar things, often specifically directly related to what the psalm says with childbearing. I know women in this church have dealt with this in their past. People struggle with infertility, and they've been told, well, what are you not confessing? Because this verse says, if you fear God, he would bless you with children. What a devastating thing that is to deal with. Let me be clear. It was not people in this church doing that to them. In their past, they were suffering from that kind of terrible mistreatment. Misfortune is the result of a broken world. It is not always the direct result of your specific sin. If you find yourself in jail for theft, yeah, that's the result of your specific sin. But getting in a car accident on the way to work is not because you necessarily had an unkind word for your kids as you were going out the door to work. Does God teach us through all our misfortunes? Sure, there are always ways for us to learn. But God does not say, particularly in the New Covenant, if you fail in this area, I'm going to send this plague on you like he did in the old. So, God does promise us blessings, and he does warn us against certain consequences for sin. But in the New Covenant, it is very different from the way it was phrased in the old. And failing to see that and turning this psalm into a contract we have with God in a new covenant that doesn't talk this way is very, very unhelpful and very destructive. So, let's zoom back into understanding Old Testament wisdom literature. How should we read stuff like this? I said it states general truths. If you live this way, generally, this is what you can expect. I think we're aware of reading Proverbs that way usually. But I think often we don't realize that there's wisdom literature plenty of other places, and there's a lot in the Psalms. And this psalm is most certainly right in line with what wisdom literature is. And so the health and wealth crowd misses that. These are general things that occur, not a contract. And so let's take a look at how the Old Covenant also then phrases these specific promises. Often when God is restating the terms of the covenant, meaning here's what I command you, here's what happens if you keep it, here's what happens if you don't. That's where we see some of these really physical promises. In Deuteronomy chapter 7, verse 12, God is rephrasing the terms of the covenant for the people, and he says this, "And because you listen to these rules and keep and do them, the Lord your God will keep with you the covenant and the steadfast love that he swore to your fathers. He will love you, bless you, and multiply you. He will also bless the fruit of your womb and the fruit of your ground, your grain, your wine, your oil, the increase of your herds and the young of your flock in the land that he swore to your fathers to give you. You shall be blessed above all peoples. There shall not be male or female barren among you or among your livestock." You see how physical that is. No infertility whatsoever for people and for your livestock if you keep the commands here. When God is rephrasing this again in chapter 28, I've said to you before, Deuteronomy 28 is very long. It's over 70 verses. The first 15 talk about God's blessing if you follow, And then the next 60 plus are all the curses that will befall you if you don't. They're all physical. None of them are eternal life or eternal punishment. They're all physical. And they are very unsettling. I don't recommend Deuteronomy 28 before you go to bed to anybody. Okay, because not only does God bless you with things like children, but some of the curses that befall you for not following is the loss of your children in horrific ways. But again, in 28:11, he says, "And the Lord will make you abound in prosperity in the fruit of your womb and in the fruit of your livestock, the fruit of your ground within the land the Lord swore to your fathers to give you." So that is the way God promises blessing for obedience in the old covenant, which is, again, earthly and physical. But this covenant is no more. The old covenant came to an end when, on the cross, Christ was dying for us and the curtain tore. There was no longer a way to approach God through that priesthood anymore. It was done. And in Hebrews chapter 8, as the author of Hebrews explaining this to people who are thinking about leaving Christianity for Judaism, he's saying, it's over. Judaism's over. And he specifically says in verse 8:13, that covenant is obsolete. You can't approach God through the priesthood anymore. As he showed Peter, these are unclean animals you're allowed to eat now. That covenant was over. So we don't throw out the old covenant. Like, well, anything that was part of the old covenant, we don't read anymore. No. We use the language of the Westminster Confession here. We say we study it for its general equity. When I see God doing things in that covenant that aren't required of me anymore, I'm allowed to eat shellfish and pork and things like that. But when I see God forbid it to them, what was he teaching in general? So I can learn from that. So we look at a psalm like this and say, what's God teaching in general, even though these specific promises of lots of children and livestock aren't guaranteed to me anymore because I'm in a different covenant? What can I learn from this? How does God teach me where I am now? So our first point was, if we're going to understand biblical happiness, finding happiness in the Lord, we have to first understand the fear of the Lord. Again, verse 1, happy is everyone. How happy is everyone who fears the Lord, who walks in his ways? So to be happy, I have to be cowering in fear? Is that how this works? No. I'm still waiting for biblical translations to finally say what we mean by that word. And it means reverence and awe. So happy is everyone who is full of reverence and awe for the Lord. And it means taking him seriously. I don't just give lip service to the fact that he's the creator of all things. I stand back and wonder in awe, like, the creator of all things, the Almighty God, wants to commune with me. He wanted to adopt me as his child and make me an heir. Therefore, if he tells me to do something, I have to really meditate on that and care and not just give lip service to it. I have to be so amazed that he would want to give all he gave to save me that I long to love what he loves, because why would I want to do anything else when I see what he's done for me? That's what we're talking about here. And the same thing for walking in his ways. It means your life actually conforms. You're actually seeking actively to live the way he's called us to live. We're not just giving lip service to it. The Psalms give us a great picture of what it means to walk in his ways in Psalm 1, which is very intentionally meant to be the introduction to the entire Psalter. Psalm 1, verse 1, how happy is the one, okay, very similar language what we have here, is the one who does not walk in the advice of the wicked, nor stand in the pathway with sinners, or sit in the company of mockers. Instead, his delight is in the Lord's instruction, and he meditates on it day and night. He is like a tree planted beside flowing streams that bears its fruit in season, and its leaf does not wither. Whatever he does prospers. The wicked are not like this. Instead, they are like chaff that the wind blows away. Therefore, the wicked will not stand up in the judgment, nor sinners in the assembly of the righteous, for the Lord watches over the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked leads to ruin. So this is wisdom literature again, okay? Very similar to what our psalm says today, but it kind of unpacks a little bit more what it means to walk in his ways. You're meditating on these things day and night. They are your food. They are your drink. And the Lord blesses that with happiness. But in the new covenant, when I'm not guaranteed to get rich, because I feared the Lord, or have a huge family because I feared the Lord. In the new covenant, what does this look like? So again, we're asking the question, how do we find happiness in the Lord? It begins by taking him seriously, meditating on who he is and what he's done. How does that look in the new covenant then? So that's our second point. We must understand true Christian happiness. So the psalm here says that in verse 2, I'll be guaranteed to eat what my hands worked for. You'll be happy. It will go well for you. Your wife will be like a fruitful vine within your house. Your children like young olive trees around your table. Scholars are agreed that the olive tree analogy is specifically saying your children will be useful. Olive oil was one of the most needed ingredients in so many things then. You won't have these ungrateful kids. They're going to be useful. They're going to be doing what you've told them to do. In this very way, the man who fears the Lord will be blessed. Okay. So I've said these are old covenant promises. We're not guaranteed physically these things today. So what can we expect? How do we do the covenantal math? We don't want to allegorize the psalm, okay? Well, happiness actually represents... No, happiness is happiness, okay? We're not doing that, but if I'm looking at general equity, I'm saying, what do I see that God's doing with his people, and how does he do that with his people today? So, what kind of promises do we see in the New Testament for specifically obedience? Not promises of what Christ will accomplish for us. We see plenty of those, but when the New Testament says, if you do X... expect why. There's not nearly as much of that in the New Testament, but there is some, and I think starting with New Testament wisdom literature is the best place, and James is probably the most clear example of New Testament wisdom literature. How does the Bible talk to us now about what happens if we obey? In James 1:12, we see this. Blessed is the one who endures trials, because when he has stood the test, he will receive the crown of life that God has promised to those who love him. So what's the meaning of that one there? True faith endures, and as a result, they receive salvation. Pretty straightforward. Here's another one, James 4:7. Resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. Again, fairly straightforward, I think. The meaning, meditate on God's truth, and it will drive away the lies of the devil. James 1:25. But the one who looks intently into the perfect law of freedom and perseveres in it and is not forgetful, a forgetful hearer, but a doer who works, this person will be blessed in what he does. It doesn't get any more specific about that blessing. So the meaning is those who seek to do God's will generally be blessed, but it doesn't say with what. It leaves that open. Christ gave us similar teaching often in the Sermon on the Mount. He actually concludes the Sermon on the Mount with Matthew 7, beginning in verse 24. Therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and acts on them will be like a wise man who builds his house on the rock. The rain fell, the river rose, and the winds blew and pounded that house, yet it didn't collapse because its foundation was on the rock. But everyone who hears these words of mine and does not act on them will be like a foolish man who builds his house on the sand. The rain fell, the rivers rose, the wind blew and pounded that house, and it collapsed. It collapsed with a great crash. The meaning, those who accept and believe Christ's words will be saved from judgment. Okay. Paul gives us a little bit of these in his epistles, not very often, but in Galatians 5:16 we hear, I say then, walk by the Spirit, and you will certainly not carry out the desire of the flesh. So, meaning, relying on the Spirit and the Word help us fight against sin. So I think you see here, there's plenty more, but we don't have time to go through all of them. What does this little survey of New Testament promises for obedience teach us? The New Covenant rewards are largely spiritual. I'm not saying there aren't physical repercussions, but they are largely spiritual. And they focus largely about what we will inherit through Christ's work. Even relying on the Spirit is a result of Christ's work, because the Spirit was not sent to us until Christ died and rose again from the dead. And these do bring blessings right now, because they help us endure. Seeing what has been done for us and seeing what the Spirit works in us helps us fight against sin. But they do not take the form of earthly riches or large families. Why? Because the new covenant does not give us physical, I'll call them vending machine promises. If I just put in my part, I'm guaranteed to get this part out of it. This is kind of what the Galatians were trying to do with the works salvation they were practicing. And Paul calls them out for it in Galatians, and he calls what they're doing elementary, and then he calls it even pagan. And that's the pagan way to approach the gods, right? I throw somebody in the volcano, and then I get rain on my crops, right? I just offer this little thing here, and then I get what I want. There's no love for God, no desire for God's glory in that. It's all about getting what I want. And there's no room for that at all in the New Covenant. The New Covenant reverses the order. The New Covenant actually says, I obey because God has already kept promises for me. Because of those, I desire to obey. I'm not obeying to get a promised carrot dangling in front of me. Something's been done once and for all that was promised, and since it has taken place and can't be changed, that moves me out of myself to want to obey. And that is where true happiness is found. What does the New Testament say about happiness that can be had in the New Covenant? It does not tie it to earthly possessions. In fact, it says it endures better than any earthly possessions we could have. Back again to Hebrews, when the author is talking to people who, again, were thinking about leaving to go back to the old covenant. In Hebrews 10, the author says this, 10:32, remember the earlier days when after you had been enlightened, you endured a hard struggle with sufferings. Sometimes you were publicly exposed to taunts and afflictions, and other times you were companions of those who were treated that way. For you sympathized with the prisoners and accepted with joy the confiscation of your possessions because you know that you yourselves have a better and enduring possession. Their joy is not tied to what they physically got by obeying. In fact, in the midst of faithful obedience, they lost their earthly possessions and they counted it joy because they knew they had something better that was not earthly, it was not physical, it would last forever. And that's why he described it. They accepted with joy the confiscation of their physical property. We see this kind of thing throughout the book of Acts as people are being persecuted for their faith, and yet they rejoice. We know that great story in Acts 16 where the riot results from Paul shutting down the pagan worship that was taking place there and the people who were making money off of it. And in verse 22, it says, the crowd joined in the attack against them, and the chief magistrate stripped off their clothes and ordered them to be beaten with rods. And after they had severely flogged them, they threw them in jail, ordering the jailer to guard them carefully. Receiving such an order, he put them into the inner prison, secured their feet in stocks, and about midnight, Paul and Silas were praying and singing hymns to God, and the prisoners were listening to them. Just incredible. We gloss over words like severely flogged. It's nearly a death sentence because so much of your flesh is torn off after they'd already been beaten with rods and beaten up by the crowd. And there they are in prison, in the worst part of the prison, in stocks, and they're singing hymns. And the prisoners are listening. You know what happens afterwards, right? The earthquake comes. They could run free. And because they knew that would result in the jailer's death, they stay put. The jailer's like, oh, they're going to get me. I got to kill myself before the Romans get me. And Paul says, don't. We're still here. And what's the very next thing the jailer says? You got something I don't have. What do I have to do to be saved? Clearly, you have something better than any of the physical situations I have here. Again, what was their physical situation there? It was almost as bad as it could physically be. Yet they have something that can bring them such happiness. They're singing hymns after being nearly mortally wounded just for being Christians. So where does this come from? Where does the ability to have happiness in situations like that come from? Well, it's not from you gutting it out, I'll tell you that. It's not reserved for the mind over matter gurus or those who have mastered all the spiritual disciplines. Our final point, God produces this and God sustains it in us. Let's tie this all together now. How do we apply this psalm's message to the new covenant era that we live in now? Psalm 128:1 tells us, fearing the Lord results in happiness. Is that just an old covenant truth? Absolutely not. No, we should have all the more reverence and awe for God because of the chapter we live in. We've been given so much more than what the old covenant believers had. We have so much more revelation, so much more clarity, and we have the Spirit of the risen Christ in us, reminding us of these things that they didn't have access to. So why should we have more reverence than they? Because to whom much is given, much is required. So we should have more awe and reverence for God every day. God produces this in us as we contemplate what he's done. So he doesn't wait for the fearometer. I don't sense enough reverence and awe. Hold on. The reverence is up. Awe is up too. Hold on. Ding, 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 ding. Hey, now I'm going to make happiness happen. No. God will come to us in the midst of our sin. He will move us. He will convict us in the midst of our sin. And the Spirit reminds us then that I can still go to him because this sin is paid for. I'm still his adopted child because his verdict can't change. In the midst of the tears of the sin that I've done, I am aware that my Father still loves me just as much as before. And that has to produce awe and wonder that I get to have a spiritual father like this. As this continues throughout our life, we're realizing this love isn't running out. My sin, I'm discovering new depths of sin that I have, and yet I'm realizing that meant Christ died for even more than I thought he did 10 years ago. He loves me more than I thought. So my awe and my wonder grows as I realize he loves someone like me. And the Spirit all the while is reminding me, you can call him Abba. You get to call him Father. That's what Christ did for you. Reach out to him. He's carrying you. Rest in him. So God creates it, but God sustains it with the continued work of the Spirit as he uses the word to point us to the truth. This is true happiness, this side of heaven. Again, not reserved for the spiritually strong, but reserved for those who see the debt they owe and rejoice in the fact that Christ has paid it for them. So we just sit back and do nothing. God's going to produce it. God's going to sustain it. I'll sin and he'll do all the work. Hardly. We need to ask God to remind us of these truths, to be actively involved in asking God, help me fight against these sins. Help me fight against seeking happiness where it can't be found, in things that are temporal instead of things that last forever. While we're not feeling that happiness, when we're longing for it but it's not there, we must cry out with the psalmist, "Why so downcast, O my soul? Put your hope in God," and ask the Lord to help kindle that fire so that I can focus on what he's done and feel that awe and wonder and true happiness, even when my physical circumstances, like Paul and Silas, like the believers in the book of Hebrews, physical circumstances have turned against me. But that doesn't mean my happiness has to go, because if it's not tied to those things and it's tied to what's eternal, it doesn't have to change at all. Lord, help me see that and feel it. I think many of us can probably attest to the fact that in some of our worst struggles, we felt God's presence and his love more powerfully than ever. One of the most spiritually rich times in my life ever was my second heart incident, where they kept me in the hospital for nearly a week, not knowing what they wanted to do. And I was so very aware of what's always true, but when things I was comfortable with were taken away, I was so much more aware, whom have I in heaven but you? Well, that's always the case. But I was made very aware of it because of the physical struggle that I was in. And I think when things we rely on or distract ourselves with are taken away and real struggle, real suffering is present, we can hear the word, the Lord more powerfully, because a lot of those other things have been taken away. Paul talks about this very clearly and very helpfully in 2 Corinthians 12, verse 7. "Therefore, so that I should not exalt myself, a thorn in the flesh was given to me, a messenger of Satan to torment me, so that I should not exalt myself. Concerning this, I pleaded with the Lord three times that it would leave me, but he said to me, 'My grace is sufficient for you, for my power is perfected in weakness.' Therefore, I will most gladly boast all the more about my weaknesses, so that Christ's power may reside in me, so that I take pleasure in weakness, insults, hardships, persecutions, and difficulties for the sake of Christ. For when I am weak, then I am strong. So he's saying, I'm truly rejoicing. God chose to not relieve the physical suffering I'm undergoing. Makes me more aware of how much I need him, how he's my only hope, and that his grace is what I ultimately need. It's sufficient. I'd love to be rid of this suffering, but he told me my grace is what you need, and that's not going anywhere. That's what you need. And when we're most aware of that, we are most happy. However, don't expect true happiness when you are in the midst of willful rebellion against God. It doesn't mean that a plague is going to come upon your house and things like that. Don't think old covenant curses here. But God will not let you enjoy your sin. He will not let you continue in these things and feel true happiness that he's designed us to feel. And remember, that's his love for you, not letting you enjoy these things, not letting you sin and find fulfillment in them. Praise his name that he gets to define what true happiness is and that it's contentment in him and resting in him that brings about true happiness, not getting our every wish and whim. So are we allowed to apply in the new covenant the benediction at the end of this psalm? May the Lord bless you from Zion so that you will see the prosperity of Jerusalem all the days of your life and will see your children's children. Peace be with Israel. I think we can. I don't say that because I'm waffling. We can. Because this is pointing ahead. This is shadow. And it's pointing ahead to reality. The Lord has blessed us in the ultimate Zion. And our place is reserved there. No one can take it away. We will see and experience the prosperity of the ultimate, the new Jerusalem, and it will last forever, and your place there is guaranteed in it. The new covenant promises us that these blessings Christ has brought to us, for our children, and for all who are far off. And right now, the shalom, the peace that God promises, we have far more than what they could have had then. It points ahead to the peace I have with God right now because Christ has brought me, the warring enemy, over to the side. By defeating me, has made me an heir of the side I was fighting against. I have peace with God now, but that's only pointing ahead to the guaranteed peace that will last forever in the new heavens and the new earth. These last forever, and they are far better than any of the physical blessings that the old covenant offered. And as the author of Hebrews says, these new covenant blessings were founded on better promises than the old, because the old depended on what you did. If you do these things, you'll get these blessings. The new covenant promises are based on Christ, what he has done once and for all that can never be undone. This hope is the only way to true happiness. God has designed you to find happiness in nothing else. If your hope is in something else, ultimately your happiness will never be true and it will ultimately fail. If your hope is in him, you can find happiness in anything because you know your hope transcends what you're going through now. And the good things you experience now, you can realize these are gifts from a father who loves me, not a paycheck that he better give or else. There's no joy in that. But there can be joy in all things, good or bad, when I know my hope is in Christ, and nothing can take that away. That's how we find happiness in the Lord.